Hi, this is Kenny Kramer, the real Kramer, and you're listening to WGXC Acra. And as Cosmo would say, giddy up!
The Catskill Food Pantry is located in the Parish Hall of St. Luke's Episcopal Church at 50 William Street in Catskill. The pantry is open to the public every Friday from 1 to 4 p.m. Healthy food is a right. For more information, please feel welcome to visit the pantry. Call us at 551-299-2456. Check the website at catskillfoodpantry.org or connect with us on Facebook at Catskill Food Pantry.
WGXE underwriting support is provided in part by Upstate Films, where membership provides access to world-class cinema, first-run feature films, art house films, live music, and more, plus advance notice of close-up series conversations with directors and actors and other special events at the Star Theater in Rhinebeck, the Orpheum in Saugerties, and traveling around the Hudson Valley. Information at upstatefilms.org. That's upstatefilms.org.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Melissa Oftemar and Tony Stone in Hudson, New York. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast, May the 29th, 2024. I'm Mike Clifford. At times Tuesday, it was difficult to tell whether former President Donald Trump or his former ally Michael Cohen was on trial. That's the take from NBC News. They report a largely stoic Trump nearly faded into the background as lawyers for the prosecution and defense laid out their summations. Jurors were treated to dueling portraits of Cohen, the star witness of the trial, and the relative significance of both his history of lies and the testimony provided in the case. The judge, Juan Mershon, kept the court in session until 7:57 Tuesday night in order to inch closer to the point at which Trump's fate is handed to the jury. That's expected to happen today. And groups fighting hunger in Indiana say they're deeply concerned about proposed cuts to the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. Our Joey Lurie reports.
Republicans in Congress have advanced a long-anticipated farm bill through the U.S. House Agriculture Committee, despite Democratic opposition to the cuts it contains. Keir Kreitz-Muller is president and CEO of Food Finders Food Bank in Lafayette. She says food insecurity is on the rise in Indiana and is already at its highest since 2014.
The farm bill plays a pivotal role in addressing food insecurity, yet policy changes proposed by the bill make harmful cuts to crucial federal nutrition programs that help millions of people access the food they need to thrive.
The $1.5 trillion legislation sets policy and funding for key food, agriculture, and conservation programs for the next 5 years.
SNAP benefits are based on the cost of budget-conscious groceries for a family of four, or what's known as the Thrifty Food Plan. It's not immediately clear when the farm bill will be brought before the full House for debate. And the New Hampshire Senate has advanced a series of bills which opponents say will roll back protections for LGBTQ+ people. We get the details from Catherine Carley.
The measures ban transgender girls from playing sports in middle and high school, ban transgender people from using bathrooms that align with their gender, and ban gender-affirming surgeries for patients under 18. Sarah Robinson, an organizer with Granite State Progress, calls the bills discriminatory and cruel.
LGBTQ+ people and those who know and love them are urging a swift veto to these mean-spirited bills that are based in misinformation. When we say live free or die, we mean everyone.
Supporters say the bills are needed to ensure safety and fairness in both sports and public spaces and protect young people from making decisions they may regret. Governor Chris Sununu has said he shares those concerns but has not indicated whether he'll sign the bills.
More than 200 businesses recently signed on to a letter to Governor Sununu warning him that bills targeting transgender youth are tarnishing the state's reputation. This is Public News Service. And a new World Wildlife Fund survey shows since 1970, more than 80% of the global populations of freshwater migratory fish have declined, and significantly.
report calls development in its Living Planet Index distressing and faults habitat loss and degradation. It says factors like river fragmentation due to dams and agricultural encroachment account for half of the threats. The Shell team monitors freshwater species for the World Wildlife Fund and says though the trend is heading downward, there are efforts underway to save these species.
On average, we've seen freshwater migratory fish populations in North America decline by 34% since 1970. This is a little bit lower within what we're seeing globally, but it's still not a good number.
The index follows more than 1,800 populations of 284 native migratory freshwater fish species from around the world. Team says these fish often make the difference in food security and nutrition for vulnerable communities while supporting the livelihoods of millions of local and recreational fishing industries and global trade. Mark Richardson reporting.
And with the Port of Baltimore nearing a return to full commercial operations, advocates are renewing their call for an executive order to address maritime shipping emissions.
Last year, 45 environmental groups sent a letter calling on the Biden administration to decarbonize the maritime shipping sector. Included among their recommendations was eliminating in-port ship emissions by 2030, with one approach to connect ships to shore power while docked. Antonio Santos with the nonprofit Pacific Environment says reducing emissions is not just about climate change.
As you're reducing emissions, you're also protecting those directly impacted. And when we talk about where these ships tend to congregate, it is port workers and those frontline communities, those port adjacent communities that are directly affected.
Brett Pivato reporting.
Finally, Eric Tegetoff lets us know workers at an Oregon hospital are celebrating their recent vote in favor of unionizing.
More than 260 Legacy Mount Hood healthcare workers voted to join SEIU Local 49. The union represents other legacy healthcare workers in the Portland area, including at Emmanuel, Randall Children's, and Good Samaritan Hospitals. Kathy Mitchell is a certified health technician at Legacy Mount Hood.
We wanted to form a union, stand up for our fair pay and respect. And not only that, my idea is I'm going to retire in 5 years, and I want this for future generations and future employees.
Next, the union will determine its priorities for bargaining and begin negotiations on its first contract. SEIU Local 49 represents about 15,000 workers in Oregon and Southwest Washington. This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member ELISA supported. Hear us on interesting radio stations on your favorite podcast platform. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Wednesday, May 29th. Local early morning temperatures range from 49 degrees in Tannersville to 56 in Copake. Regional average soil temperature is 62 degrees. Pollen levels for today will be high. Hopefully, those levels take a hit this afternoon when rain rolls on through, likely between 2 and 8 p.m. We get a high temperature of 71 degrees that will linger most of the afternoon. Overnight, light chances of rain, and we see a low of 53. If you're camping, make sure you got that rain fly. Tomorrow, rain chances vacate by noon, and we see a high of 73 at 4 p.m. Overnight, will be dry. Temperatures dip to 48 degrees. Friday, will be sunny, comfortable, high of 74 at 4 p.m. Weekend is also looking nice. Sunny both days with highs near 80 and comfortable sleeping lows in the 50s. Today's tide schedule is low tide at 1:53 a.m., then high tide at 7:55 a.m., low tide again at 2:54 p.m., then high tide once again at 8:48 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 76 degrees, and the tide strength will be average. Sunset today will be at 8:08 p.m., sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:19 a.m. Looking way up, we see X-class flare chances are up again 30% for today. Plasma winds will be slow at 335 kilometers per second with an average density of 5 protons per cubic centimeter. So far, it appears we do not have any Hadouken on the way. Radio propagation conditions are currently bad till dark, then fair below 15 megahertz overnight. There are no chances for aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 141. And this has been the better weather for Wednesday, May 29th, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
Wake up! Wake up, wake up, wake up! Up you wake, up you wake, up you wake, up you wake! This is Mr. Senior Love Daddy, your voice of choice, the world's only 12-hour strong man on the air, here on We Love Radio.
Box with tubes. Human beings make machines, but no one knows how to control them all. I don't know what the knobs and switches are for. I program my toaster oven and pretend I'm in charge. But actually, I know nothing of the secret circuits and wobbling wheels of artificially intelligent robots.
That was Catskill's Rodney Allen Greenblatt with the title song from his 2023 album, Box with Tubes.
I'm Jeff Economy, host of Snack Point Charlie, heard the first and third Wednesday of every month from 10 to midnight here on WGXC. I'm here today on WGXC's afternoon show to talk with Rodney Allen Greenblatt, who will be performing as part of the drive-in extravaganza on May 31st. That's Negative Land plus Sioux Sea, Matmos, and Rodney Allen Greenblatt at the Greenville Drive-In, May 31st. Tickets available at wgxc.org/drive-in. Welcome, Rodney.
Thank you. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you for coming. My pleasure. So tell us about this drive-in show. You're going to be playing at a drive-in?
Yeah, it's very exciting. The Greenville Drive-In is a great place. They have converted an old drive-in into something that's much more
culturally present and fun. And I've been to a couple things there. And I haven't been to a concert the size of the one that's going to happen next week. But I'm sure it's going to be great.
And you have a relationship with Matmos, is that correct? Or you've just played with them before? Or
Somewhat. I'm actually a fan. They have inspired my music over the years, and I've been a steady listener to all their albums as they come out. And then about 2 years ago, I went and I saw them play in Montreal, and it was a small club, and they did their show, and it was fun. And I got to talk to them, and I gave them my tape of my last record. I'm not expecting anything of it, but they wrote me back a couple weeks later. They liked my tape. And somehow or other, this guy communicated with WGXC friends. And when they decided to put this show together, they asked me if I wanted to play. So I'm playing for one of my favorite bands. How about that?
That's excellent. I'm curious about how you got into music in the first place. I mean, I've been familiar with your visual work since the 90s, really. I mean, I was, like a lot of people, completely charmed and enchanted and semi-obsessed with Parappa the Rapper and Umjammer Lammy. I actually had to give my PlayStation away because I was spending far too much time on the gaming platform. But it came as kind of a surprise to see years later that you were making music. How did that part of your practice evolve?
Well, actually, I've been making music all along. I started learning to play when I was 7 years old on a Hammond organ. And I've always loved electronic music, actually, not knowing that it was a specific thing as a kid. But I would have done anything to get a Moog synthesizer when I was a kid. But it was way too expensive, and I couldn't convince my father to kick over $3,000 in 1974 for a Moog synthesizer. But I can afford one now, thanks to Parappa the Rapper. And over the years, I've made lots of music. Actually, the very first song in Parappa the Rapper, the scene in the movie theater, the opening, mm-hmm. I wrote that music.
Oh, cool.
And played and sang it, actually. And I think Masaya Matsura added some instrumentation and drums and things to it. But basically, I've been doing little bits of, you know. But I've been gigging. I was in a band in art school, a couple of bands. And now, since I moved to Catskill 8 years ago, I found lots of people to support me and play my music in places. The Avalon Lounge has been great. And I've been at it all these years.
Yeah, tell me more about the Monday morning thing that you do.
Yeah, every Monday morning, I'm in a band called Music for Furniture, and we play improvised electronic music for an hour and a half. Starting at 8:30 a.m., people are coming in and having their coffee, and in the background is a orchestra. Sometimes it's usually a quintet of the five of us playing improvised music. David Garland is there, and he actually plays the clarinet and the bass clarinet and the guitar, so it's not all electronic. And then we have his son, Kenji, on very interesting computer program synthesizers. And then Dan Kirkus, who you may know as Catskill Bread. He's an amazing musician, and he plays a variety of synthesizers and devices. And then Jimmy Garver, he is kind of a laptop genius, and he provides all kinds of sounds. Then I'm on the Moog. We're sometimes all five of us, sometimes less. But every Monday, we're back there at Joust Cafe in the middle of Catskill.
I I have to confess I've never seen you play, and it's partly because I'm such a night owl. My typical bedtime is around 3 or 4 a.m., so getting up at 8 is a bit of a challenge for me. But
it's a challenge for everyone. It's a crazy time to have a gig, but that was the whole original concept, to have a music gig that was just at a time when no one would expect it. So that's what we do.
Do you find that most people have no idea that you're going to be there when they come in, or do they come just to see you?
Well, we have a bit of a following, some just neighbors and friends, but they all work on their laptops and do their email while we're playing. And we love that, actually. And the coffee is good, and there's food, nice food at Joust. So, yeah, it's a great place to hang out and listen to us go through an adventure, basically. We just go through different phases of music and sounds, and it's pretty interesting.
And you have a project with Jimmy Garver, is that correct? Or I mean, I'm sorry, I know that you have one. I can't remember the name offhand, but I have heard the record. But tell us a little bit about that.
Jimmy and I have collaborated on something called Sending.
That's it.
And like I said, he's a genius at bass and drums and sound effects. And I basically add my Moog-y sounds on top of that. And we made a record together a couple years ago. It sounded pretty good.
Yeah, I've played some on my show, and I know it's been in rotation on WGXC as well.
Mm.
I'm curious about your philosophy towards electronic music, towards a synthesizer. How would you summarize your approach? I mean, not that it has to be summarized in a sentence, but give me an idea what where you're coming from, where you're going with it.
Hmm. I've always been fascinated with it, to be able to create your own sounds, or edit sounds that are found on the machines. I think in a funny way in my mind, electronic music is very pure. It comes out of a circuit or some kind of device inside of a machine. There's no strings or sounding board or anything like that, although it gets connected to those kinds of things. It's just this strange, interesting sound. I think when I was a kid, I went at video arcades, and I was wondering where the music was coming from. Was it coming from a recording? And I realized, no, actually the computers are generating those weird little video game music. And that made me really interested in how that was done. And as soon as I could afford to buy a synthesizer, I did. And I started to learn how you make those different timbres and different effects and different kinds of sounds.
It's interesting that you... one of the first things you describe is the clean quality of the sound. And I'm wondering if that in any way ties into your visual practice, because so much of the visual art you do has a kind of 2D quality and a very mm-hmm. deliberate one, it seems to mm-hmm. me. And I'm curious how those things, if you see any relationship between them.
Yeah, I suppose there is. I do like some simplicity, and I always move towards some kind of visual simplicity in a certain way, in a cartoon kind of a way. And I've actually, if you listen to some of my solo music, there is a kind of a cartoonish flatness, I guess you could say, to some of it. And I guess that's just natural for me.
When you say that's natural for you, it's I don't think it's natural for necessarily everyone. So me, and it's not a pro or con. I mean, I'm drawn to that myself, but I'm curious how that's natural. I mean, and that might be impossible to explain and asking someone to get into that, the basis mm-hmm. of their art. And maybe that's something you don't want to go into, but I'm curious how that's so natural to you.
Right, right. Well, I mean, I've talked about in many interviews, the basis of my art is basically, animations that I watched on TV when I was a kid. I had artistic talent at a very young age. My parents discovered. They felt that I was an artist. But the art that I was actually looking at that was forming the aesthetic that I love was on TV, like Gumby, for example, that animation series, and also Bullwinkle and all of that interesting animation, very flat, funny, slapstick, interesting stuff. That's like deep back brain kind of thing. When I look at Gumby now, you can watch episodes on YouTube or something. The forms and the colors are so much like my forms and colors that I've used in my adult life. Everything about it just sort of went back into the storehouse back there and just keeps coming back up, which I think is great.
Well, it's interesting to me as well, because Art Clokey was a notorious proponent of Zen, and there's references to it in the Gumby shorts, you know, Gumby going to the Zen cafe for coffee or whatnot.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how that ties into your interest in Zen.
Well, I don't think I caught that when I was a kid watching it, but I have seen in the scene, there's a little town that they drive through, and there's a Zen cafe in the town that they sometimes drive by. Gumby and Pokey drive by in their Model T, I think. But anyway, my interest in Zen was kind of separate from all that in a way. I don't know. It's a long story, but when I was a kid, I found or was given a little keychain with a little Buddha on the keychain. And I wondered, what was it about? And I always had an interest in Buddhism since then. Forgot about it for a while. And then, as you know, I worked in Japan when I worked for Sony. And I used to go to the temples as a tourist. But I was still thinking, like, what are these Buddha statues? What is this all really about? There must be some profound meaning. But I didn't know what it was. So then I couldn't get any of my... None of my Japanese friends could explain it to me. So I figured there must be more to it. And I knew that I could find a Zen temple when I went back to New York, where I lived. And I did find a Zen temple right around the corner from where I lived. It was the Village Zendo. And I started there in 2008.
So did you have any prior religious or spiritual upbringing? Or did that just come out of the blue, like that Buddha appeared and that was what set you off?
It pretty much came out of the blue. My father's family was Jewish, and my mother's family was, well, my grandmother anyway, was a Catholic. So I got to see both of those things. I guess neither of them made much of an impression. I'm not sure, but I wasn't really necessarily interested as a kid. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, 10 years old or 12 years old or something. For some reason, the little Buddha and then the temples and all that stuff appealed to me.
It just occurred to me as you were talking about this, I have a little Parappa, sort of a flat figurine that I got from the Rodney shop when that was open. It's on the dashboard of my car. And I just realized, thinking about it, that the outline, the shape of Parappa is actually pretty similar to the sitting Buddha.
I have not thought of that before, but why not? Yeah, little, like some kind of a, like Southeast Asian Buddha with a pointed top or something. That's interesting. Maybe so. Who knows? I mean, I was in Japan. I worked for Sony for 10 years. I didn't live there, but I was going back and forth quite a bit. And I was really into seeing temples and learning about Japanese culture. So yeah, why not?
So do you think that, how conspicuously does that present itself in the music? I mean, the things I've heard, there's not any, it's not like, oh, this is religious music and it's very forward, but how conscious is that to you when you're making the music, or is it just part of everything that you do and you don't even think about it?
Yeah. But I think for me, Zen is about the self, letting go of the self, then finding out who you really are, expressing yourself in an honest way. And I think I've somehow been able to do that. It isn't religious or Buddhist in any way, but it's the kind of music that makes me happy. I enjoy making it. I guess I'm not that concerned about other people listening to it. Because if I did, that would be a problem. But I don't. I just love making electronic music. And I think it's just me expressing myself very honestly, I would guess.
So do you still do are you still running the Zen practice for other people? I remember I had a postcard a long time ago that announced that you were doing that, and I wasn't sure if that was still an active practice.
Yeah. In fact, I'm running the Catskill Zen Circle. It's right here on Main Street. You can look it up on the internet, Catskill Zen Circle. And I'm the teacher there, which is a lot of fun. We have a great group. It's easy to do.
Excellent. So tell me a little bit about what you have planned or what people can expect to see when they come to see you at the drive-in show.
Yeah, I know from looking at my Bandcamp and my Apple Music streams that not many people listen to my music, I just decided I'll make new music. Like, what would it matter? It isn't like they're coming to hear their favorite songs. So I've made 6 new short pieces, and I'm going to fit them into 20 minutes. And it's going to be fun. I've been rehearsing, and my gear is over here, and I'm going to play 6 new songs for you all.
Excellent. I look forward to hearing them. Can you tell our listeners what your websites are so they can find your music?
Oh, yeah. For my music, go on Bandcamp / Rodney Allen Greenblatt. That's easy enough. And then my website that I've had for years and years is called whimsyload.com, like whimsyload, L-O-A-D. And I've had that website for, I don't know, almost maybe 30 years I've had that URL, and I've had that website. So it has a lot of my artwork and some stuff about Parappa and my other projects and links to other things.
So is there any chance that we'll see a return of the Rodney Shop in any form? Will there be a one-time pop-up even at some point?
Probably not. I realize the retail business is incredibly difficult. And I sold most of the stuff that I had collected. So that was kind of a goal. I made lots of friends. I mean, it was really fun, but I don't think I'm going to put it back in the brick and mortar form. Now, I sell on my website some of my stuff and some Parappa stuff. I'm still getting samples from Japan, so once in a while I put them up there.
All right. Well, there's a lot of opportunities for people to enter the world of Rodney Allen Greenblatt, which is who we've been talking to and who you'll be able to see Friday, May 31st at the Greenville Drive-In in Greenville, New York, along with Negative Land and Matmos. I should say Negative Land plus Sue C., their visual collaborator.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you, Rodney, for talking with us. And
thank you.
We'll see you then.
Thanks so much, and see you at the show. Oh.
Catskills Rodney Allen Greenblatt there with Canned Sauce from his 2022 album Near Earth.
Hi, this is Rodney Greenblatt from Catskill. And you're listening to WGXC, ACRA, 90.7 FM.
La despensa de alimentos de Catskill está localizada en la parroquia de la Iglesia de St. Luke en Catskill, en la calle William, número 50. La despensa está abierta todos los viernes de la 1 hasta las 4 de la tarde. La comida sana es un derecho. Para más información, bienvenidos a todos a venir. Llamar por teléfono a 551-299-2456, mirar la página web catskillfoodpantry.org o conectar con nosotros en Facebook en Catskill Food Pantry.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Catherine Adams is a curator at MPAC and has been working with the Sanctuary to bring incredible programming to North Troy, such as the upcoming participatory workshop with Theo Jean Cuthand on May 30th, plus past events such as Ilopango, The Volcano That Left with Beatrice Cortez, and Petra Kupas with her dream performance and workshop. And I'm glad to have Catherine Adams with me now to discuss more about her work and MPAC.
Hi, Sina. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome. So glad to have you here. I'd love to just start with your background and how did you become a curator?
Sure. Yeah. So initially, I would say kind of my formative years in training were initially sort of a little more academic. I was very excited by, aesthetics and philosophy. But I think all throughout the time I was studying, I was always very engaged in art. I think I found that artists were asking through their work a lot of the questions I was interested in, things about sort of the possibility of making work in an autonomous way, raising questions about representation and value. So there was that kind of intellectual dimension to the work that I was drawn to. And on the other side, I had had a very close kind of relationship to the arts growing up. So I had trained as a dancer for some time, and that gave me a sort of intimacy, I think, with kind of how artists develop their work and build a career, although I didn't personally pursue that. And I didn't set out initially to be a curator and didn't realize that role was kind of available to me. But in retrospect, it was really the perfect fit with my array of interests. And I would say also that just working with artists as I was kind of coming up and doing projects outside kind of gallery jobs really gave me a lot of exposure. And it was often the support of artists that really drove me to like formalize my commitments to the field.
So you did mention autonomy and representation. Can you maybe talk more about those and just generally the themes that excite you when researching programming?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say the way I think about this in the abstract is a little bit than how I might think about it at MPAC. With MPAC, I would say my research is definitely, because it's so focused on singular artist projects, I really tend to start more actually with what an artist is thinking about, engaging with the materiality of their work, how they relate to the histories of their field. So I would say that that's maybe sometimes more prominent now in my work, but definitely, when I'm thinking about themes or kind of building out that kind of framework for an artist, I try to really follow the lead of the work, but I do think get drawn to kind of pull out sort of like the geopolitical dynamics that an artist might be engaging with. Of course, especially with MPAC, you know, questions around technology, its impact socially, how it, you know, affects how we see the world are very prominent. And I think that, you know, oftentimes those political questions and technological questions are sort of two sides of the same coin. So, you know, I try to look for work and themes that enable kind of reflection on these kinds of hinge points where there's a formal choice that an artist is making that reflects both a kind of like technique and then maybe also reflects on a larger question.
What are the factors that allow you to realize that that person is a suitable fit for MPAC, which is a high caliber engineered space? There's also a lot of room for experimentation. What makes somebody right for that space?
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's a very unique space. And I will say, you know, as a curator whose field now is really the visual arts, that's kind of the discipline that I primarily support. It's, you know, unlike, say, dance and theater or performance, artists sometimes are not coming to that space with the same relationship to production. So I think, you know, when I'm looking for artists, I'm often looking for people who either perhaps have kind of an existing engagement, say, with cinema or film and have, you know, a project they haven't yet been able to realize that could really use the support of MPAC. Or I would say I look at people who maybe have a kind of undercurrent in their practice that hasn't been able to be explored, something that's performative, something that is cinematic, even if they may be like a sculptor. So I think sort of figuring out, you know, who is at a moment where they can really push their work. I think also just finding people at a stage where they feel kind of confident in their practice. So I, you know, I work with artists at all career stages, but I think, you know, that sort of set people's sense of kind of certainty and comfort in their work, kind of the, you know, the vision, these kinds of like sort of cliche things that actually still, you know, become quite important, especially for artists who, you know, are coming to this very unique space where there's different kinds of constraints than perhaps in other kinds of artist residencies.
What went into curating Theogene Cuthand, who is the media artist who is coming to MPAC on May 29th and to the Sanctuary on May 30th?
Yeah, so Theo's work is really fantastic. And this collaboration, of course, as you alluded to at the beginning, it is a collaboration with IAIR through IAIR Presents, which is a program that enables MPAC to collaborate with some of the RPI arts faculty. So Kathy High and Brenda Miller are very involved in this as well. And then, of course, we're coming to the Sanctuary for one event. But I was also familiar with Theo's practice prior to this event. I came across his work at a film festival last year. And saw a few of kind of the key works that have come to mark his career. And the work is this really amazing, funny, kind of autobiographical filmmaking. It's kind of DIY. It's very humorous and ironic and playful. But it really engages with like heavy topics in this kind of inviting, clever way. And, you know, I think also for me, the engagement with Indigenous issues was really key. So Theo is a First Nations artist from Canada, I believe Cree originally. And so, of course, that's also a major part of his work. And, you know, I've been quite interested in kind of thinking through issues of sovereignty for Indigenous communities and looking to kind of expand the canon of art and film to, you know, include those voices. And of course, you know, it was perfect for the Sanctuary, I think, as well, just because of how closely you all have engaged with the Indigenous communities in Troy and your attention to questions of colonialism and land and ecology. So I think it was a kind of perfect convergence of common interests between kind of, you know, an artist I'd been exposed to, an artist Kathy and Brenda were interested in, and then also the sort of geographic, like regional relevance, I think, of the work as well.
And there are some other programming coming up at MPAC. What else is on the calendar and how can people find more information?
Yeah, sure. So we are sort of at the end of our spring season. So Theo is the last public event we will have for a little while, but we do start up again with the academic year in the fall. So look out for our season announcement, which will happen over the summer. And in the meantime, you can keep track of everything at our website, which is mpac.rpi.edu. So we'll have a lot more to share with everyone soon. And yeah, in the meantime, you can catch other events as well and sort of see what we're up to with also research and campus too.
And MPAC is spelled E-M-P-A-C. So something you mentioned earlier was that you didn't realize that the role of a curator was available. I think that's a common thing is a lot of people see artists or like the very common roles available. What should people know about the role as a curator and, you know, maybe someone's listening who didn't realize it was available for them?
Yeah, I love that question. There's a few dimensions to this. You know, one is kind of curating as a field, as we understand it within contemporary art, is still kind of new and fresh. So there's like a lot of ways in which people are still carving out what it means to curate. There's a lot of different models, depending on whether one is independent or institutional. You know, I was certainly lucky to come up in a time where the field was broadening and there was sort of more openness to, you know, perspectives of, you know, artists of color, curators of color. But I think also more generally, for people who are curious, research and writing are also really key parts of curating. You can kind of test the waters by just kind of meeting artists, you know, considering ways to show work. And that can be in a format that isn't necessarily large scale and public. You know, it might be through something more experimental. I think that for people who are interested in the field, you know, really allowing yourself to engage in the kind of social and relational side of it helps a lot and really is ultimately throughout, you know, curatorial work, it's always relationship based, you know, when you're working with artists and you're working across a lot of different kinds of partners. So, yeah, I think that's sort of what I would say. But yeah, it's a really flexible and interesting and challenging field.
Thank you so much for that explanation. And Catherine Adams, it's always such a pleasure to have you on Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Calling all radio enthusiasts. Have you ever wanted to be on the radio or learn how to edit audio? Got a great idea for a short segment to play during our drive time shows? Start making radio with us at WGXE 90.7 FM as part of the WGXE Community Contributors Program. No prior experience needed. For more information, contact content@wgxe.org. That is content at WGXE.org.
Catskills' Rodney Allen Greenblatt with the song Bubble from his 2021 album To Just Be.
WGXC has a new call-in number for anyone to leave a three-minute message that we will play back on the air. Listeners can leave as many three-minute audio letters to the editor at 518-212-7509 as they want, and WGXC will let your voice be heard on the local airwaves. The number again to call in and record a three-minute message that will be played back on 90.7 FM is 518-212-7509.
Thank you.
That was Farfisa Gnome Fish Chord from Catskill's Rodney Allen Greenblatt from his 2021 album, To Just Be.
And you're tuned in to WGXC 90.7 FM during our local music pledge drive. This year's pledge drive is themed with local music because we play local music all year round, all the time. And regional music, music from up in the Catskill Mountains, from over in the Berkshires, from up in the Capital Region, from down in the Hudson Valley. You hear all about it on WGXC, and you hear about local shows in local venues up and down the Hudson River, across into the Berkshires and beyond, into Ithaca and Binghamton. WGXC is a source for the local music scene and a source for you to find out information about what's going on musically. When bands come to town, you can hear what they sound like first on the radio at WGXC 90.7 FM. We're asking you to support all that, support the local music scene, and support WGXC and support community radio and the hundreds of voices that are on the radio at 90.7 FM, telling you stories from tribes that you don't usually hear from, listening in to teenagers and senior citizens and everyone in between. That's what is on WGXC. And we're asking for your help becoming a sustaining supporter today. Right now, we are 80% to our goal of sustainability, and we need those last few 20% people in the community, the most important folks. You're holding out. You're waiting to see if WGXC comes through. We think we have. We think we provide a valuable service in this community with valuable bilingual programming, with programming from young people and from older people, with all sorts of different voices from the community, all different shapes, sizes, and colors, and perspectives on the radio at WGXC. So please become a sustaining supporter today at WGXC.org/donate. That's WGXC.org/donate. Become a sustaining supporter today. So all this continues tomorrow on 90.7 FM. So you continue to hear all about great local music, about international bands coming to town, and more. Stay tuned to Creative Community Radio WGXC, and you'll know all about your music scene. If you want to keep it that way, go to WGXC.org/donate and become a sustaining supporter at WGXC during our annual pledge drive. We're asking for your help right now to keep 90.7 on the air. Go to WGXC.org.